All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Deborah. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm up here telling myself that I sit in the palm of God's hands and I'm amongst my people, so I'll be all right tonight. But I think we all get a little bit jittery sometimes when we do this, and I'm certainly feeling that way tonight. So I'm going to do what I know how to do when I get up here, which is do exactly what Megan said, tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. First, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me. It's a privilege to be invited anywhere, and I remember that. I remember a time when I wasn't invited and when I was talked about that girl, you know? And to be invited somewhere and to be welcome, to be escorted not to somewhere outside of the room because we want to get rid of you, but so people can come greet you. I guess they're making some assumptions that y'all are going to want to greet me, but I have a better chance today than I did when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess we can start there. I came to the rooms, and my sobriety date is April 4th, 1983. My home group is the Happy Destiny group of Durham, North Carolina. We meet on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 7. We have a big book study. Come on down anytime. It's the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know, and I know that you may disagree with me, and if you do, I'm happy for you because that's how you should feel about your home group too. I'm a lucky gal, I can tell you that. I'm a lucky gal. I'm blessed beyond anything that I could have ever imagined, and definitely beyond anything I ever deserved. I am grateful to stand in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't always that way, but I couldn't imagine being anywhere else. You people have my heart. So I'll tell you a little bit about how that happened. So, of course, I grew up in, well, not of course, not everyone does, but many of us grow up in alcoholic families, and I did. And my father was alcoholic, and I knew from a very early age what alcohol did to people. I knew that there was a lot of rage and fear and insecurity and dysfunction in my house because of alcoholism. I didn't know the word was alcoholism, but I knew that it had to do with my dad and that gallon of vodka underneath the sink and the gallon of vodka on top of the sink. I knew that that mixture made for a lot of unhappiness, and I didn't want to be that way. And I always say that because I never intended to become an alcoholic. I never intended to become the wreck of a person that I became. I never intended to hurt you. I never intended to hurt myself. I never intended to become the disgrace that I became. But it was inevitable. It was absolutely inevitable because I am an alcoholic. Now, you know, I've come to these rooms and I've heard people talk about cucumbers that turn into pickles and other kinds of vegetables and things like that. And I don't quite understand that because when I began to drink, I drank alcoholically from the very beginning. It was just a matter of time. It was just a matter of actually putting the alcohol into my system. But I believe that I've always been this way. I didn't grow into an alcoholic, nor can I grow out of being an alcoholic. So here I am, really in the only solution that I could possibly have, which is to be amongst a spiritualized community called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't drink for a while because I didn't want to be like him, and I didn't want to be like my sister. My sister also drank and drank alcoholically from the get-go. She was 15 months older than me, and you'll hear about her later on in my story. We were cut from the same cloth, absolutely, and the only difference between her and me, the only difference was that Alcoholics Anonymous came into my life and stayed, and it didn't for her. And although she tried, and again, I'll tell you a little bit about that, but she also got into some other substances, and so there was a lot of chaos in my house, and I was the good kid, and I stand before you, so you can have some pity for my mom. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't intend to drink alcoholically, and I didn't intend to do the things that I did, but I don't have control, and that's actually why I stand before you, is that I can't predict what's going to happen to me when I begin drinking. So I didn't drink for quite a while. When some of the kids around me started to drink, I didn't drink. And I was the chaser gal, and they would drink alcohol, and I would get them water, and that was really boring. because I watched, you know, people become inebriated and drunk, and it was really like, hey, they're having a good time, and I'm watching them have a good time. So I decided that I was different, and I was brighter and cuter and smarter and everything else, and that I could probably handle it, whereas my father and my sister couldn't. My alcoholic ego was already budding then. And I was somewhere between 10 and 11 years old. I think I was 11 years old when I began drinking. I am a young person with a little age on her. And I've had the privilege of growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to these rooms and I stayed when I was 15. I don't think that I would have survived much beyond that age. And as I tell you some of the stories, I hope that you know that that was just my life, and I just don't think that I would have made it much longer. Some of us can, and some of us can't. I know that when I came to the rooms of AA, I was suicidal, I was homicidal. I hated you, I figured you hated me. I had a God, but I didn't think that God would have anything to do with me at all because of who I had become. I wasn't even about surviving. I didn't have hope. I didn't have a desire to survive anymore. And I thank God that Alcoholics Anonymous welcomed me when I came to you as a young person. Now I stand before you, again, as a young person with a little age on her. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And if you're young and you're in these rooms, like I saw there's a crowd over there. Yeah, they're like, woohoo! You can make noise. Like, I'm good with that. And how do you all feel about them? There you go. You know, some of them wouldn't have the privilege of making it in here and dragging themselves in when they were 40 or 50 years old. So thank God they're here. And thank God Alcoholics Anonymous welcomed me. And I remember very clearly that the old timers, when they began working with me, they didn't treat me like a 15 or 16-year-old. They didn't treat me like a girl. They didn't treat me like somebody who dressed inappropriately. They didn't treat me as anything other than an alcoholic. Anything other than an alcoholic, and that's always how it should be in AA. But anyway, let me tell you about how I got to that point where the old-timers had anything to do with me. So I began drinking because I didn't want to be the chaser girl anymore. And oh my God, did I fall in love, like immediately. Like, oh my God, right? So every bit of insecurity and fear and pain and anger and discomfort that I felt as a child in an alcoholic home went out the window, and I found that warmth, and I found that magic, and I remember that going down, and I chased that for the rest of my drinking. That feeling of warmth, that feeling of release, that feeling of ease. And that is so what I always wanted. That was so always what I wanted. And alcohol became my first love, and alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. And I don't know why I couldn't do it for myself. I had good examples in my life. I had not so good examples in my life. But for some reason, I lacked the fundamental ability to live life on life's terms and be okay with myself and my God and my world. I just couldn't do it. And when alcohol hit this system, I found my release. I found my answer. I found my freedom. And I was off and running. Off and running. And you know, like I said, I was about 11 years old, so it wasn't like appropriate to be drinking at any time. And so, you know, while it began as a weekend warrior thing, it very quickly went into an anytime, anywhere, anyhow thing. Because, like I said, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so I would wake up and I'd be like, okay, how can I do something else today? And I did use other substances other than alcohol, but you know what? I'm not going to talk about that tonight other than to tell you that I did. Because I'm desperate for Alcoholics Anonymous to stay Alcoholics Anonymous. I need it to stay the way that I found it. And I'm not willing to bastardize it by making it my version. I'm not willing to change the steps. I'm not willing to change what we do in these rooms. I have kids that you're going to hear about later, and I need you all to be there with a big book and conference-approved literature and willing to take them to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the way you did to me. So I'm not going to change it. But I did do other things, but alcohol was my first and strongest love. And I tried to control everything. I figured if I only did this and that, and I only did it so much, in certain ways or whatever, everything was going to be okay. I was the great director from the very beginning, you know? And obviously I stand before you, so that plan didn't work either. But I tried because, again, I never intended to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to hurt you. I didn't want to cause the chaos that I caused. I just really wanted to be okay. Like, fundamentally, I just wanted to feel okay, and I didn't know how to do that unless I was drunk. Now, I drank to get drunk from the beginning. I don't understand social drinking at all. I understand there are some people out there that can do that. I understand some of you Al-Anons do it. That's good for you. I don't get it. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see why anyone would put anything into it. First of all, this stuff really doesn't taste good. All right? Coca-Cola, sugar, that tastes good, you know? But it did something for me, so I frankly didn't care what it tasted like. But I went to college 2 years sober, and I saw these girls sucking on a beer for, like, you know, 2 hours, and I'd be like, what are you doing? You know, like, that's not how you're supposed to drink. Let me tell you how you're supposed to drink, right? And I also had this affinity for hard liquor. Like, I loved hard liquor because it was very efficient, right? And it was very powerful, right? Like, you could do with hard liquor in a second what would take a long time with beer. But beer went down really smoothly after you threw up from the mixture of hard liquor that you stole from your parents' liquor cabinet. So everything had a place. And that's really how we did do most of our drinking, because you can't, when you're 11, go up to a bar and plop your 20 down and say, bring it on. So what we did was we stole, and we stole from our parents' liquor cabinets, and they would have these, like, you know, jugs back in those days of, like, right? I mean, they didn't have these little, whatever, they had these things. And, like, by the time we were done, it was this much water and this much whiskey, you know? And we emptied everything, and we would put it all into a thermos, and we called them suicides, because that's what they were. And we would just, it was amazing. I mean, I look back, and I'm still like, oh, you know, which tells you why I'm here, that I still feel that way. But anyway, that's how we drank. And I also stole from other people, because, you know, their stuff became too watered down after a while. And what's funny is that, like, we would break into people's houses and steal their hard liquor, and that's it. Now, like, tell me how dumb that is. Like, we didn't take money, we didn't take jewelry, we didn't even look for those things. We took their hard liquor. You know, like, something right there, it tells you what's wrong with me. You know, it's like, I'm not interested in anything about you or about what you have other than how it's related to getting some liquor into me. And that's how it was. Again, once I discovered the freedom that alcohol gave me, that's what my life became. Every day, how do I do this? And I ran with people that drank like me, because the people that didn't drink like me became really annoying, like really annoying. And I still have problems with them sometimes. Like, I always talk, like they're so good. My mother would be like, you know, why can't you be more like Lisa Larkin? Obviously, Lisa Larkin isn't one of us. And Lisa Larkin this, Lisa Larkin that, Lisa Larkin, Lisa Larkin. And I still have this, like, Lisa Larkin resentment, because it's like, seriously, like, I'm not Lisa Larkin. Hello, I never will be. And you know, it's really funny, because now as a professional, I give talks other than in AA, of course, once my mom came to hear me, and I'm giving this professional talk to, like, hundreds of people, right? And I mentioned Lisa Larkin in there, too, because it's really an enduring resentment. And so I work her in there, right? And then so after the talk, like, everyone's clapping, and yeah, it was great, and whatever, my mom comes up, and does she say, oh, my God, I'm so proud of you. You've done, your education paid off. You're amazing. Look at all the, no, she's like, oh, let me tell you about Lisa Larkin. Let me tell you what she's doing. I'm like, are you serious? Do you want me to drink? No. Anyway, Lisa Larkin, I love you. I can pray for her today. Anyway, so I didn't understand these people, and I knew that I was different. Like, I know that everybody in here, except for the Al-Anons, God bless you, and maybe you too, didn't feel normal. I mean, we don't feel normal because, frankly, we're not. And I wasn't comfortable in my own skin unless I was drinking. And so in order to drink, I hung out with people who drank like me. And you'll hear more about my little crowd in a minute. But I was crazy because, there was a lot of fun. If alcohol didn't do something for me, I wouldn't have kept doing it, okay? It made me feel great, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, anyone looking at us would be like, ew, you know, here's some sloppy, smelly girls. But that's not what we felt like we were. We felt like we were princesses on top of the world, right? And guess what, guys? You know, you stunk too. But when you're drunk, you don't really get that you're stinky and ugly and all of that, right? So we were having a grand old time. But I started finding that I was becoming somebody that I never wanted to become. And I started to lie, and I started to steal, and I started to compromise all of the values that I had. And, you know, when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't lose a house and a family and kids and all of that, because I didn't have those things. But anything that was ever important to me, I lost. I lost. I lost all of my values, I lost my priorities, and most of all, I lost me. When I came here, I didn't know who I was, because frankly, I was whoever you wanted me to be. I was whoever you wanted me to be to get what I wanted, you know? And that's how I saw you, too. I didn't ever see you as a person. I didn't see you as someone that had pain or love. I didn't see the capability. I never saw God's light in you. I saw what I could get from you. That's who I became. And I knew that. And I hated myself. And I figured you hated me. And like I said, I believed in God, but whoa. You know, the stuff I was doing by the time I was 12 or 13, he wouldn't have anything to do with me. So things started happening. Bad things started happening, because that's what happens to us. I'm going to tell you a couple of my war stories, but not too many, because I like talking about sobriety. Because I like talking about the light of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like talking about being in the palm of God's hands, because that's where it's at for me today. I need to remember where I came from, and I need to always have a grateful heart for where I am. But I like focusing on where I am, because life today is really good. But I'll tell you my suicide story and my homicide story, and then we'll move on, right? So my suicide story, actually I'm going to tell you one other story because it's pretty important for me. I wasn't blessed with a whole lot of blackouts because I don't know why, I just wasn't. I had these like brown outs or gray outs, whatever you want to call them, where things would go in and out, sort of like, you know, if you're watching TV now and you see these horror flick commercials and everything's flickering, right? That's what it was like. I would have these flickering pictures of like, what I would do, and it would come back to me and it's kind of frightening stuff. And you have this sneaking suspicion that the stuff in between that you don't remember is even worse, right? And it's just an awful, awful feeling, but you don't quite completely remember. And one of these nights was a night in, I don't even know where it was. Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky, I think, where the World's Fair was. I was hitting bottom. I was 14 years old. There was hard liquor and a boy involved and a ski lift, I think. And that I remember. And then I can remember the hotel room where I was covered in blood and bruises and dirt. And I was trying desperately to wash it off of me. To wash it off of me. And I know that you people have been there too. And I was trying to wash all of the alcoholism and all of the dirt off of me. And I couldn't. And the insanity of that night is that I couldn't ask for help because I didn't want to get caught. That was the insanity of my drinking, is that I couldn't even see this broken girl who just needed to say, help me, because I was afraid of getting caught. And if I got caught, you might say something about my drinking. And I'm sorry, that's just not on the table for discussion. And whenever you tried to put it on the table for discussion, you said, Deb, you're drinking too much, I would say, look at my sister or look at my dad. I'm doing all right. I got this. Well, obviously, I stand before you, so I didn't. But that was what my drinking became. My suicide story is that I was in, I was in 9th or 10th grade. I sobered up in 10th grade, at the end of 10th grade. And I was in one of these, you know, regretful funks, and I decided that I wanted to end my life. And I used to carry around this knife in my little macrame purse, which is, you know, you guys remember that from like the early 80s, right? And or maybe it was the 70s. I'm always like a decade behind. And I was like, and it's kind of funny that I carried this knife around because, like, I can't use a knife. Like, to this day, I'm always, like, asking people, can you help me cut the apple? Because I'm, like, not good with knives. But it was like, when I... with the burnouts, I had to be a burnout. When I was a jock, I had to be a jock. And when I was, you know, whoever I was with, I was this little chameleon so I could get your stuff. And so I had to have a knife because that was a part of a prop of something, I'm sure. And so one of these days where I had reached that jumping off point that we talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we're ready to just end things, I had gotten there, and again, I hated myself. I figured that you hated me and that God hated me too, and I was ready to be done. I was in way too much pain. I hated what was happening to me. I couldn't wash it off. I couldn't stop it. I didn't understand. I really didn't understand what was wrong with me. I just knew that something was very, very, very wrong. It was always that boy, and it was always my mother, and it was always you. It was never my drinking. But I knew that my life was awful, and I was done, and I decided that I was going to kill myself. So I got a hall pass so I could go to the bathroom and kill myself. I go down in the bathroom, I open my macrame purse, and my knife is gone. My knife is gone, right? And so then I start getting agitated. Like, remember when you were like, I mean, remember when you were new? Like, oh, God. No offense to the newcomers, but I don't want to be new again. And, like, I was like, looking for my knife, and I couldn't find it, and I'm getting more and more agitated and more upset. And then finally, I recognized that my mother had dumped out my macrame purse and taken all the objectionable items out of it the night before, which she did, you know, on a quarterly basis or so. And then the amazing thing is that I flew into an alcoholic rage. Like, it didn't occur to me that she might have saved my life. And in fact, that didn't occur to me until I was about 4 years sober, to be totally honest. But instead, what happened is I flew into this, like, alcoholic rage where I was like, why doesn't she trust me? You know? There was not a trustworthy inch on my body at any time for anyone. But, you know, we get so belligerent and we get so, you know, like, oh, and that's what I was. And I was, and so she saved my life. So my suicide attempt was thwarted, and my alcoholic rage kept me alive. And really my mother and a power greater than myself did. My homicide story is that I was drinking with the girls. These were the girls that I actually loved a whole bunch. So these are the girls that I cared for to the best of my ability. Now, I'm alcoholic. I'm a practicing alcoholic, so that's not real good. Okay? Like, my capacity for love was a little distorted. But I did care about them. And these are the girls that I would once in a while get honest with, and I would say, you know, hey, Sal, I feel like killing myself. And she'd be like, me too. Let's go get drunk. So these four girls would run together, and one of us actually turned out to be normal and just experimenting. And the second one, I'm going to tell you in a minute what happened to the four of us, but the second one was the one I tried to kill. And I don't know exactly what we were doing that night, but I had a psychotic break, which sometimes happens to us when we drink. And I actually had delusions, and I thought that she was the devil and that it was my duty to kill her. And so I went to the kitchen and I got the biggest butcher knife I could find, and I don't know how, because this chick was bigger than me. I stopped growing when I started drinking. And I don't know how, but I pinned her, and I was going to kill her. I mean, I really, really, really believed that that's what I was supposed to do. And the only thing that stopped me, which I think was divine intervention today, I think it was God looking out for me and doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, is that girl number three stepped in and took the knife away from me. And the crazy thing about it is that since we all drank the same way, the next day we didn't say, you know, maybe we should go to treatment, or maybe we should go to an AA meeting. We laughed about it and got drunk. And that was the chaos of my life. It was either I'm trying to kill you, I'm trying to kill myself, getting a hall pass to do these things, waking up full of dirt and blood. This was how I lived my life. And at the core of it, every day that I possibly could was, how can I get something to put in me, because I can't stand myself sober. And so I'm going to take you up to the end. And the end was in February of 1983. A friend of mine got in a drunk driving accident, and he died. And I decided I was going to try to stay sober because this was getting out of hand. People around me were dying. People around me were, like, getting sent to treatment and jail. You know, the things that happened to us. And I decided to stop drinking, and I did. And I white-knuckled it, and I didn't have a big book, and I didn't have steps, and I didn't have AA, and I didn't have a sponsor, and I didn't... live life on life's terms, so you know it didn't last. I did white knuckle it for a while, and I know that I'm capable of doing that. And that's actually important information for me today, because that period of my life was one of the worst periods I have ever experienced, because I didn't have AA, because I didn't have a big book, because I didn't have steps, because I didn't have a God of my own understanding alive in my life. And of course, I drank again. Of course. Now, that until the end, which was just a few weeks, was awful. It's a big, huge blur. If I was awake, I had something in me because I couldn't stand it anymore. And I remember the end where no matter how much I drank and how much I drank, I just couldn't get drunk enough. And it was an awful place to be because I couldn't get sober and I couldn't get drunk. And I just kept trying and kept trying, and there was just such a desperation there and such a hopelessness. And I couldn't find my freedom anymore, and I couldn't find that warmth anymore. And alcohol stopped working for me, but I didn't know how to live sober. And it was awful. And then what happened was those four girls started, God came crashing into our darkness. And like I said, one of them was okay. And then the second one, who was the leader of the pack and the one I tried to kill, got sent away to treatment. And then the third one, as a result of that, started going to these AA meetings. And then me, I said, ladies, what are you doing? I'm not going with you. And I didn't. And for a little while, I drank with other people. I found other people to drink with. And the truth is that we can always do that. Like the big book says, if we get dropped in from a helicopter in Alaska, we're going to find an Eskimo with a pint, right? But there's always someone to drink with. Someone's like, woohoo, you've done that, huh? And I drank with other people. But I was curious because these were the girls that I loved to the best of my ability. And so I decided to go to an AA meeting to see what it would be like for my dad and for my sister and for you smelly people and for them. Not for me, because me and my drinking were just fine. And so I went to my first AA meeting, and that was in Cleveland, Ohio. It was a speaker meeting. 95% of the meetings are there. I did grow up in Cleveland, and I did sober up there in the heartland of AA. And, yeah, woohoo, okay. And I went to my first meeting, and I don't remember anything that was said. I think the speaker's name is Connie, but I used to make a lot of things up back then, so I'm not completely sure. And I can't really tell you about anything that she said because, you know, I had the attention span of a bug. It's a little bit better today, not much, but it was awful back then. But I can tell you that when we got up to pray, I cried, and I cried hard, and I cried because I knew I was home. And in that moment, that was when I had my moment of clarity. And in that moment, I knew I was with my people. I knew I was alcoholic. I had no reservations. And when I was ready and I had my moment of clarity, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And I once again want to say that y'all didn't treat me like a 15-year-old. You didn't treat me like a girl. You didn't treat me like someone that smelled or dressed inappropriately. You treated me like an alcoholic. When my hand was there, you put your hand in and you brought me into the fold of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank you. So I began going to meetings because I knew I was home, and you people, God, I would look at you and your eyes were clear. Most of you didn't stink. You laughed. You laughed. And the only thing I couldn't really get was that you said you had like a year and a half sober. And I was sure you were lying and just trying to get something from me. And then these old-timers would have like 20-some years, and it was like, that's not even, you know, I couldn't fathom staying sober for months, let alone years. I just couldn't understand that concept, you know. I look at the promises and comprehending the word serenity. There were so many things I didn't comprehend, so many things. But I wanted what you had from the beginning because I sensed that you were at peace and you were happy and you had a freedom that I had left behind a long, long, long time ago. It was the first time in years that I felt any sense of hope. And like I said, I knew I was with my people. And even today, after I've been sober and comfortable in my skin for quite a while, I have a successful career. I have a life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I serve on boards and committees. I'm well-respected in my community. But there's nowhere I feel at home like when I'm in a room of AA. And I am so grateful to have this community, to be a part of this spiritualized community that Bill Wilson wrote about. that Bill Wilson began. So I'd like to tell you that I got a sponsor, worked the steps, read the big book, and lived happily ever after, but I'd get struck drunk because it's not true. What I did was I picked the best-looking guy in the room, and I chased him around for a while. And if you're new, don't do that, because he became my higher power. And lack of power was my dilemma, and so that wasn't good. And if you're on the other end of that and you're 13th-stepping people, stop, because that person you save is probably someone you might kill by doing that. So after a couple weeks, this boy said to me, well, this really isn't healthy, which was code for I'm ready for the next one. And and I had to make a decision. And in those few weeks, I had been to enough meetings, and I heard about the fear and the hopelessness and the panic and the rage and all of the things that I were. And then you guys would sober up in your stories, and you'd start talking about freedom and serenity and, you know, service and God. And, you know, it was all Snoopy talk at that point, like wah, 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 you know. But I had to make a decision. I was either going to go back to where I was coming from, or I was going to stay here for me. And I really wanted what you had, and so I stayed. And so I did get a sponsor, and I did start working the steps. And what was really funny is in the beginning, you know, I worked the steps the way I wanted to. Right now, I know I'm not the only one in the room that did that. And this is what's hilarious. We have a fatal illness. We're willing to say, yes, I understand I'm going to die from alcoholism. And then our sponsors say, well, I want you to go to so many meetings. And we say, well, maybe two, maybe on Tuesday night and Saturday morning if I've gotten enough rest. And we're like the most belligerent people on the face of the earth, seriously. Like, how many cancer patients do you see saying, I don't want radiation except on my terms? Like here's the only hope we have, and we're like, ugh. Okay. So, and that was me, you know, I was doing it my way, and my way almost got me drunk. I was about a year and 2 months sober, and I was ready to either start taking some instruction or leave. And the thing is, you don't know if it's going to happen at a year and 2 months, or if it's going to happen at 2 months, or if it's going to happen at 4 months, but it always happens. You know, the book and even our traditions talk about it, the fact that if we don't conform, we don't stay. And so, you know, I don't have to tell you to conform. You're either going to conform or you're not going to stay. And I got to that point where I had to conform, so I went to the old-timers, and they scared me. They really scared me. Now, I'd like to tell you they scared me because they were scary, but they weren't. They were just sober alcoholics. But they told the truth, and they could see right through me, and I knew it. And so they scared me. And I'm going to tell you about my three old-timers. I had a big book old-timer, a story old-timer, and a principal old-timer. My big book old-timer, he taught me the book, and he said, you read the first 164 pages, you read 2 pages a day, not more, not less, not more because you're not that smart, and not less because you're lazy. And then he would quiz me on it, and he'd see me, and he'd be like, what's our code? And I'd be like, oh, I don't know. And love and tolerance is our code. There was no love and tolerance anywhere in the room, you know. What's our next function? Oh, I don't know. To grow in understanding and effectiveness. And this is how I learned the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was great because when someone I sponsored needed something, you know, I kind of figured it out because I was terrorized into it. And frankly, I think we should do that now with the service manual. Don't you think? Patty? Yeah. All right. So I learned the Big Book that way, which was amazing because I learned how that you could actually take the steps as they're outlined in the book. Because I was the kind of alcoholic, I would ask 20 people the same question to pick the least, you know, the easiest, softest way. And we know how that works out. And so I started following instructions the way they were in the book. And my stories old-timer would tell me stories. And my principal old-timer is Mel. I'm going to just take a minute to tell you about Mel because he was amazing. So Mel and I met when I was 2 years sober. I was 17 years old. And I don't know how old he was, but he was a day older than God, okay? He was old. And I also don't know how long he had sober, because it depended on whether or not he counted his jail time. So sometimes it was in the 20s, and sometimes it was in the 30s. But he had a lot of time sober, too. And what I didn't know for a while was the reason that Mel was always at this club that was open 24 hours a day was because his wife had passed. I was young. I didn't understand what that meant. The world was all about me back then anyway. So I didn't know that his heart was breaking and that he had to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober and alive. But thank God he had to be there. when he was there, so was I. And we used to have these old-timers young people awards because there's a whole bunch of young people. The gold rush of young people in 1983 hit Cleveland, Ohio. And the old-timers were like, oh, my God. and they'd be like, you know, they'd be like, we spilled more beer on our tie than you ever drank. And we'd be like, well, you're a messy alcoholic because I got the alcohol in me, not on me, you know. and so... So we did this, but then they were like, okay, kids, sit down and shut up, and, you know, if you're going to mess this thing up, there's the door. Don't mess this thing up. I want to stay sober today. And they started to, one by one, teach us some respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started teaching us the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started teaching us that you don't get up in the middle of the meeting, and they started teaching us that you don't take the old-timer seat. Thank you very much. And they started, again, they taught us simple things like respect. That was something that when I came to the rooms, I didn't know what it was. I didn't have respect for you. I didn't have respect for me. I didn't even recognize that you were actually a human being. And I didn't know what that meant for a few years anyhow. So they started teaching us these very simple things. And then they would each pick one of us, right? So like Mel picked me, and then the big book old timer picked another young person, and then they would have wars on like who was doing better in school. Well, mine got a 3.8 GPA. Well, mine got a 4, you know, until we did something embarrassing and then they didn't know us at all. Oh. It was fantastic. And once again, we were in the folds of Alcoholics Anonymous. Once again, we were at the old timers table. And they would teach us things, and they would teach us the literature, they would teach us the steps. And they said, kid, if you want to live, if you want to stay sober and you want to live, you're going to have to work the 12 steps of AA, and they took me through. So Mel was my principal's old-timer, and he taught me about things like my attitude and my anger and my rage and about God and about prayer and things like that. There are many people that have come and gone in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave me gifts that have become a part of who I am. Blind Joey, God bless him, shot himself in the head after he stopped going to meetings and started drinking again. But Blind Joey taught me about God, and I'll never forget it. You know, I'll never forget him. That's what happens to us when we don't stay. That's the bottom line. But the gifts that we have, you know, the lifeblood of the sober alcoholic, my God, the lifeblood of the sober alcoholic is such an incredibly powerful thing, because not only are we sober and able to live as decent human beings when we're sober, we're able to help yet another alcoholic stay sober. That's incredible. That's incredible, but only when we're here. Mel became my best friend, and Mel and I palled around for 10 years, and even when I went away to school, we stayed in touch, and Mel had an eighth grade education, and so he couldn't write real well, so when I went away to school, we sent each other tapes, and he taught me more about life than any human being has ever taught me, and I don't think I'll ever have a teacher like Mel again. I'm grateful. I am so grateful that I had him. He was brilliant. He thought the world was flat. We argued about that. Okay? We argued about a lot of things. But he was brilliant because he did teach me about freedom, and he did teach me about God, and he taught me about the four absolutes and about honesty and unselfishness and purity and love. He taught me about spiritual principles and how to live life sober, how to live a sober life, how to live in a way where I didn't have to drink again, how to live in a way where I didn't have to wake up with regret and fear and pain anymore. These are the things that Mel taught me. And when he died, when I had 12 years sober, I had the privilege of giving his eulogy. And I understood very clearly that he was the best part of who I was, that he had become a part of the fabric of my life, and that he had passed it on, and that that's what I was supposed to do. And so I hope you all have had the privilege of having a Mel, but more importantly, I hope you all get to be a Mel one day, you know, because that's what it's about, and AA is giving it away. So the things that worked for me in the beginning, having a sponsor, going to meetings, setting those meetings up, tearing them down, being a part of our community still work for me today. I am sponsored. I sponsor a bunch of girls. I stay in the middle of things. And three principles that are really important to me in my sobriety are faith, service, and gratitude. And I'm going to take just a couple minutes to talk about those three things, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about my sunlight. My faith started in a very pathetic way, because like I said, I didn't think God would have anything to do with me. And y'all would tell me, pray, ask God to keep you sober for the day, and at the end of the day, thank him. And I didn't know how to talk to God. You talk to him. I didn't know how to do that. In this meditate business, I would just fall asleep. And I didn't know how to do that. So what I started doing was I started telling God jokes. You know, I was a kid. I was in school. I would hear these jokes. I would hear them, and I'd say, hey, God, did you hear this one? And so if you're going to do that, be sure to ask him to keep you sober, too. But you know what? What that was it was just an ounce of willingness. It was an ounce of willingness. I came to God the way that I could come, humble and with sincerity. That was the best that I could do. And what's really amazing is that I have grown from telling God jokes to living in the sunlight of the Spirit and having a conscious contact with a power greater than myself that is amazing. You know, amazing. No matter what is going on in my life today, whether I'm angry, whether I'm resentful, whether I'm fearful, anxious, whether I'm happy, whether I'm free, no matter what, I can pause and be still and be with the God of my understanding. And that's something that you guys gave me. And that's amazing. And it didn't start out that way. But oh my God, do I understand today that I'm in the palm of God's hand. Oh my God. And that is incredible, because no matter how messed up things are, I know that I'm okay, and I know that I can stay sober, because lack of power is my dilemma, but I have a God in my life. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't get to tell you what your God should look like, and you now didn't get to tell me. And I hope that that's something that we always keep very, very clear in AA, that we never kill an alcoholic by saying your God has to look like mine, that we never kill an alcoholic by making them uncomfortable by saying, you pray like I pray. We say here, come, find a God of your own understanding. Start talking. Tell him some jokes. Just have some willingness, and that seed will grow. And so I have an incredible faith today, and I also have gratitude, and that's a very important thing for me, is no matter how bad things are, is to recognize that God is in my life and that you are in my life and that I have many more blessings than I ever should have. And you know what? I'm not anything special. I'm not special. I'm an alcoholic that has worked the 12 steps. I have found my sunlight. I have found my freedom. And if you're in here and you're working the 12 steps, that'll happen for you too. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about service, because service has been really important for me. And I've been involved in general service for about 14 years now. And you know what? General service is not for everyone. If you don't know what general service, so if I start Snoopy talking to you right now, if you're like, what is she talking about? Then get with someone, get with Patty. Sorry, Patty. get with your GSR, get with your DCM, like people that are using these acronyms. Talk to them, because service is incredible, and general service isn't for everybody, but it is for some, and at least try it on. At least learn what it is. At least support it, because it's one of the things that keeps Alcoholics Anonymous what it is. Okay? When I walked into the rooms of AA, there was a big book, there was pamphlets, people were talking about 12 steps, and they were talking about God. That was 28 years ago. I know if I walk into your home group, that's what I'm going to hear. I have gone to the other side of the world, where AA was only 1 year old, and I heard about God, the traditions, steps, and the big book. I had nothing to add, which is pretty incredible. You know, that's because we keep AA what it is, and one of the things that keeps AA what it is the General Service Conference and the service legacy that we have. We have three legacies. One of our trustees was heard to say, I heard this secondhand, but I loved it, is that we have the steps to prevent suicide. We have the traditions to prevent homicide. And we have the concepts to prevent genocide. Isn't that great? Now, those of you that don't know that we have 12 concepts, we have 12 concepts. And they're to be found, they're essays that Bill wrote about our service structure and about the principles that guide our service structure, and they're incredible. Like, oh my God, they're incredible. And they're in the back of the service manual. And if you don't know about them, then just check them out, because they're such an important part of who we are as a society. And I'm a member of this society, and I'm proud to be a member of this society. And you know what? I want to give the best of who I am to this society. And I want to make sure that it stays that way so that when my kids come here, it's exactly what it was for me. So I'm going to tell you about how the kids are my sunlight, and then I'll sit down. So I have 5 kids because I do everything alcoholically. And yes, some of you are going places you go with that. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about them, because they are my sunlight. And I realize that some of that might scare a lot of you, like, oh, that's not what I want. And that's okay, because your sunlight doesn't have to look like mine, okay? But this is my freedom, and this is my happiness. And there's nothing that sets me free like the laughter of my children. And I'll tell you that my dad fell down because he was drunk, and he had a brain bleed, and there was 2 months where he was sober. And you know what? We were friends. We were friends. This is a man who I feared, who I hated, who I couldn't be near, who was toxic. But during those 2 months, we were friends. And I want to give that to my kids over and over and over and over again. So I have to stay here for myself and for them. So about 12 to 14 years, but somewhere around 13 years ago, I was newly involved in service. I think I was a GSR, and I met my husband, and I'm not going to get into that story, but because I'm running out of time and other reasons, but there's not enough time. Anyway, I met my husband, and he had a child already, and Brandon at that time was 6, and he just turned 18. He just graduated high school and is living as a normal member of the community, and I love that child, and it's a privilege to have him as my stepson, and that is amazing that I can say that. It's amazing that I can say that. It's amazing that I can say, hey, you know, this is a child that came in, that crashed into my world with his dad, and we traveled this journey together, and now he's a young man, and he's out in the world. It's like, oh my God, you know, I've become a member of society. I have a family. And I'm proud of the kid. I love him. And so when I became DCM, we had our first biological together, Noah. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about service as we go along, because every time I got a new position, it seemed like a new kid came along. And you guys started teasing me about it after a while, saying, what are you guys celebrating? Because, like, I would get elected, and then, like, you know, the next fall, there was another baby. So Noah was the DCM baby. And Noah, so he was my first biological, and it was amazing because when he was born, I fell in love. And you know what? I fell in love every day. And every single day of my life, I have the privilege of falling and being in love. And how amazing is that? And Noah was the evidence in my life where I could no longer deny God's love. There was so much love and so much amazement, I could no longer deny God's love in my life. And I don't know about you, but when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt broken. I really, really believed that I was a broken person. And that feeling of being broken followed me into the rooms, and I carried that for a long time. And I know that there are people in this room tonight that feel broken. And you know what? I wasn't broken. I was a drunk. And when I stopped drinking, I stopped doing things that made me a broken person. But when Noah came along, it taught me so very clearly that I wasn't in the wrong line. I always felt like I was in the wrong line. I'm in the wrong line. I'm in the broken line. I'm in the line where it's inevitable that something bad's going to happen. Because you know what? It always did because I drank, right? But once I sobered up, the bad stopped happening. And Noah came along, and it was so clear that not only was I not in the wrong line, I was in the line where God hands out golden candy every single day. Every single day. So I'm an alcoholic, so what do I want? More. So I start campaigning for another one. And my husband was like, we have two, it's all right. And I'm like, no, we need more. And so, because when is two ever enough, for God's sake? And so I was elected Area 51 secretary, and along came Max. And Max, I can tell you is that when Max was born, I learned glee, and I started dancing with my children. And I didn't think that it was possible to exponentially feel more love, but I did, and it was amazing. And I was so grateful to be sober, so grateful to be involved in service and in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so grateful to have this kind of love. So, of course, I wanted more. And I started campaigning for another one. Now, he is not one of us. So he was like, no, we really have enough. We have three boys. And I'm like, no, it's not enough. And so I was working on that. I was going to my sponsor. I was writing. I was doing the inventory about this, right? And not a it. I'm not real big on it. In fact, I was over 20 years sober, and my sponsor was like, you really don't understand what the word acceptance means, do you? No. And so what happened was my sister, who I told you about in the beginning, accidentally overdosed and died. And she wasn't found for 5 or 6 days. And, you know, I tell that not because it's a gruesome story. It is a gruesome story for someone to not be found for 5 or 6 days. But I tell that because that's what happens to us. The only difference between her and me, the only difference between her and me was Alcoholics Anonymous. She was so toxic to be around. Nobody went looking for her for 5 or 6 days. I'm gone for 5 minutes and people are looking for me. You know, that's AA versus not AA. So she died, which is what happens to us. She never made it. She used to call me drunk and say, I want to take that step where you write down everyone you're mad at. I'd be like, you might want to stop drinking first. She tried. She never made it past 90 days. And I know that she tried to sober up. She did some jail time. I know that some people tried to reach out to her. But she didn't make it. And in the back room was her 18-month-old, who she used to lock in the back room to keep her safe. And that child survived. And so then we had 4. And that child was a girl child. So now we have some pink and purple in our life. And she's amazing. And she's mine. So that was really time to stop, right? But you all know, because I told you that there were 5, and you elected me as alternate delegate. So 9 months later, baby Chance was born. And, you know, all I can tell you, I try to journal about the kids once a year so that they can look back and know what it was like for me to love them in their early life. And the first time I journaled about baby Chance, I wrote that it was like God blew me a kiss and whispered, here's one more. Because he so knew that I loved the babies. And so then you elected me delegate, but it came with really good practical suggestions about separate bedrooms and things like that. And frankly, you kept me busy enough being a delegate that there was no number 6. And my life is full and my life is good. And serving as delegate, so I served as a panel 59 delegate to the General Service Conference, and I know there's a couple of past delegates in the room. And serving as delegate was a life-defining, amazing experience. I'm so, so grateful to have been able to travel that journey, to try to give the best of who I was to Alcoholics Anonymous, to work on behalf of AA as a whole. That's what I went to do once a year and throughout the year for those 2 years. And I remember going to the bleachers in Times Square the first year and just crying for the alcoholics, crying for my sister, crying because of the immense responsibility and privilege that I felt as I went to do the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was amazing, and I'm so grateful that Bill and Bob set this thing up so that we can keep it what it is. And he did that by giving us the conference, by always making sure that AA stayed in our hands and that it was our program and it was our responsibility. That was an amazing experience. And then I rotated, as we all do, and it's been good to rest. The concepts I mentioned are related to world service and general service. There's concept 9 is about leadership, and general service has taught me how to be a better human being. I'm a better mother, I'm a better friend, I'm a better sponsor, I'm a better sponsee because of the principles of general service as well as Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole in my life. The concept 9 talks about leadership principles like vision, responsibility, tolerance, flexibility. These are things that don't come naturally to me at all. These are things that I want to be when I grow up. And I know that my only chance of growing up is to stay sober and to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so very grateful for you. I'm so very grateful for the hope in my life. And I just want to say that, you know, sometimes adversity happens. I don't always feel like I'm in the middle of the sunlight of the Spirit, even though I live and I breathe there and I often dance there. There are times where life is hard. But I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I will get back into the warmth and the sunlight of the Spirit because my God loves me. You people taught me that I don't have to drink. You people taught me how to inventory, how to be go to meetings, how to sponsor people, how to use all the tools that keep me sober and will bring me back into the sunlight of the Spirit, and I'm so very grateful to you. Surely I'll meet some of you as we trudge the road of happy destiny and dance in the sunlight of the Spirit. Thank you.